Our collective nightmare. A New Year's Eve hug turned into evidence. A man who arrived as a friend, left with his life stitched into a courtroom timeline. A woman who spent the holiday texting and dancing and giving a child a homemade necklace, disappeared into a catalog of witness memories and unanswered logistics. The last hours of Anna Walsh, sketched by friends and a calendar, look ordinary until they do not. A festive kitchen, a sleeping trio of children, a photo sent to a man whose name now sits in the record like a footnote to ruin. Two friends testified that Anna had said the marriage had cracks, and that she had reached a breaking point. That was ordinary too, until it wasn't. Brian Walsh, who has admitted to illegally disposing of a body and misleading police, keeps the louder mystery. He insists he did not kill his wife and claims to have found her dead hours after the last visitor left. The courtroom has been given both the tidy facts of confession and the stubborn mute of what actually happened. The law files both and watches them stare at each other. There is a federal fraud thread in this tapestry, forged war hauls and guilty pleas that kept the family in Massachusetts when the mother wanted to be with her children. There are petty human ornaments on top of this, rumors of affairs, a jealous mother, a psychic mentioned like a bad sitcom plotline. Everything familiar, every domestic grievance and headline-ready scandal, rearranged into a slow-moving machine that produces grief and testimony. About 50 witnesses field the record across 8 days. Friends described late-night phone calls, an exhausted woman, a night of dancing where someone said she seemed upended. The prosecution rested. The defense will get to speak. The trial will march on like a municipal clock announcing the obvious. Something terrible happened in a house Americans would rather believe is private. This is how we process private collapse in public. We schedule it, we assign witnesses, we print the names of people who were last to see someone alive, and we listen as if procedure equals truth. We take confessions that spare the worst word and watch lawyers explain what a medical examiner might say about a mysterious death in a seemingly healthy person. There is a kind of ritual comfort in the courtroom's motions, a professional choreography of sorrow that lets the rest of us keep believing institutions will produce answers. The ritual is neat. The answers are smaller than the ritual promises. The children remain backdrops in a case we are practicing on like a stage. We will hear the defense. We will hear explanations about sudden, unexplained deaths and the limits of certainty. We will hear a man who admitted to hiding a body insist innocence of the worst charge. We will nod, file this under human catastrophe, and then move on to the next headline that looks like a domestic tragedy in a different suit. The country has become adept at turning quiet domestic endings into public exhibits, and then pretending that legal theater repairs anything. It does not. We keep watching, polite and exhausted, as if watching could stitch absence back together.
Sophie Kinsella, Madeline Wickham to those who knew her, wrote a whole career out of one glorious, embarrassing truth. In the first world, shopping is both a hobby and a therapy session you pay off with a tap. Becky Bloomwood's biggest crises were misplaced receipts and romanticized debt. Our biggest crises are delayed shipments and the emotional fallout of a sold-out limited edition. It's almost elegant. Kinsella sold more than 50 million books, translated into 40 languages, and gave us permission to laugh at our own ridiculous priorities. Then, privately, she fought something none of Becky's spreadsheets could budget for. Aggressive brain cancer. She wrote about that too in a novella after surgery, which is to say she did what great comic writers do. She turned real pain into clear-eyed human writing instead of a new hashtag or a viral apology video. The weird cultural reflex here is instructive. We post condolences in Helvetica, quote a line we liked, slide into the comments with three X's and an emoji, and file it under showed respect. Meanwhile, we keep treating consumer convenience as a moral weather system. My weekend is ruined. The boutique closed early, newsflash. The boutique isn't the universe. First world problem of the day. We can mourn an author who taught us to laugh at our own excess while still insisting that our most urgent emergencies are colorways and delivery windows. That hypocrisy is comedy gold. And Sophie was the mapmaker.
Antarctica has started hosting tiny, furious weather systems under its ice. Think coffee and milk swirls the size of small cities, and they are busily shredding the shelves that hold back the glaciers nobody wanted to think about until the water reached their doorstep. Researchers calling these things sub-mesoscale eddies watch them race beneath Pine Island and the doomsday-adjacent Thwaites, plucking warm water from depth and playing a fast, efficient game of chemical warfare against ice. measured on hours and days instead of geological epochs. These underwater storms accounted for roughly 20% of the melting at those two glaciers over 9 months. Short-term chaos doing long-term harm. The ocean's weather behaving like a vandal with a precise schedule. The physics is almost quaint. Warm meets cold. They spin, they mix, and the rough underside of an ice shelf gets hit with a steady, hidden current of warm salinity. That meltwater then freshets the near-shelf ocean, lightens and stirs the water column, invites more turbulence, and hands the eddies a bigger toolbox. Positive feedback, scientifically described, politically ignored. Thwaites is the star of this slow-motion horror show. Its ice shelf is a cork on a bottle of Antarctic ice. If the cork goes, the bottle pours. Losing Thwaites means more than a couple of coastal inconveniences. It locks in feet of sea level rise, with cascading scenarios that specialists put in the language of disaster planning and coastal real estate math. Of course, the science comes with humble footnotes. Most of Antarctica sits where boots rarely go, so models and a handful of instruments carry the narrative. It's complicated, say the experts, which is their polite version of the sentence the rest of us should be. Reading plainly, we are extrapolating from scarce observations while the clock is running. The broader irony is hard to miss. After a century of forgiving planetary insults, we're astonished to find the planet responding with normal physics. The ocean's small, fast storms are doing the job of eroding the ice in real time, while decision-making operates on fiscal quarters and headline cycles. Nature's machinery is precise, indifferent, and increasingly active in places we assumed safe. If you like metaphors, imagine the planet stirring its own coffee and deciding the continents could use a new shoreline. The study is a reminder that collapse rarely arrives like a siren. It shows up as 1,000 sensible, short-lived events that, together, redraw maps and rewrite what counts as normal.
This week on the Existential Crisis Hour, a reflection inspired by a CNN article titled "Mystery Foot Fossil May Shake Up Human Family Tree." Scientists found a 3.4 million-year-old foot with an opposable toe and some scattered jaw fragments, and suddenly Lucy, our long-hyped poster child for uprightness, might be demoted from celebrity ancestor to one more branch on a very messy family bush. The new bones belong to Australopithecus deyeremita, a neighbor of Australopithecus afarensis, who apparently liked climbing trees and pushing off with the second toe rather than the big one. Evolution, it turns out, had no loyalty program. We built stories about clean lines and inevitable progress because they make us feel smart. The fossils laugh by being inconvenient. Two species, same neighborhood, different diets, different feet. They walked differently, ate differently, and somehow managed to coexist without resolving the human ego's craving for a single heroic ancestor. The universe remains stubbornly uninterested in our need for a neat origin story. There's a quiet comedy in the painstaking work. 27 tiny jaw pieces recovered by sifting dirt, while we humans, masters of narrative, sift through myths and textbooks, searching for a single thread that ties us to greatness. Instead, we find a tangle. Ancestral populations radiating like the branches of a tree that refuses to be a ladder. The more we dig, the less comfortable the plot becomes. If Lucy loses her throne, it won't erase the fact that we ended up upright, curious, and capable of inventing existential radio segments. It will only remind us that being human is an improvisation, patched together by chance, competition, and convenience. In the end, our origin stories are less like family albums, and more like attic boxes of mismatched photos, some labeled, most mysterious, all subject to reclassification. From CNN's report, "Mystery Foot Fossil May Shake Up Human Family Tree." A small foot bone asks a very big question and gets a simple answer. Evolution doesn't care about our metaphors. We insist on meaning. Nature supplies complexity. The rest is interpretation, argument, and more fieldwork. And somewhere in Ethiopia, someone will keep picking through the dirt one inconvenient piece at a time.
The capitalist fever dream. They call it sustainability. While stacking profit margins on top of a runway, a 2 kilometer strip of concrete becomes a curated park, an aviation past repackaged as character and sold as an amenity. Heritage is trimmed and marketed. Memory becomes aesthetic value for the next wave of condos. Preserving old hangars is dressed up as carbon consciousness, when the real calculation is cheaper than tearing down and rebuilding. Retrofitting becomes another revenue stream. Film studios, light manufacturing, clean tech showrooms that will pay premium rents while the developer collects staged green credentials. Environmental risk is handled like a public relations line. Specialized consultants will help us understand and mitigate legacy conditions. Reads like an admission that contamination exists and will be managed, not remedied. Forever chemicals are a footnote. Liability is outsourced. The river of private profit keeps flowing, while public health gets negotiated behind closed doors. Nature gets reimagined as an amenity. Native habitats and bioswales will be planted, not restored. Wildlife will be invited back into an orchestra pit of manicured ecosystems, calibrated for stormwater control and Instagram angles. Ecological function is reduced to flood mitigation and property value enhancement. Transit infrastructure is waved at like a benevolent afterthought. The site sits near stations, so planners can claim walkability, even as cars are tacitly tolerated everywhere but that flagship runway park. Token bike lanes and a last-mile bus network are enough to brand the project progressive, while the real condition, private capital setting mobility around profit, remains unchanged. The financial model is honest in its cynicism. Build a phase, extract a return, reinvest, repeat. 30 years of perpetual construction becomes a business plan for constant speculation. A city that never finishes guarantees never-ending demand for mortgages, management fees, and little luxuries sold as civic improvements. Luxury brands and editorial partnerships narrate the whole operation as noble. When prestige sponsors attach to sustainability, the moral ledger flips. Environmental urgency funds lifestyle real estate, and journalism becomes an accessory to the sale. Greenwashing isn't a bug, it's the product. This is urbanism as asset management. Every tree, every library, every recycled slab of runway is priced, parceled, and optimized. The wider collapse of democratic planning, of shared public goods, of a livable future not parceled for yield, shows up in the details. The runway is not being turned into a park so people can breathe. It is being converted into a long, landscaped price tag.